Welcome to Radio Free Thinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. My name is Ethan, your free-thinking historian and executive director of CFI Vancouver.
And this is Don, your political science philosopher.
This is Rob, cognitive psychologist.
This is Daniel, a second-year art student.
And we have a special guest with us on the line. And special guest, say hello.
Hi, this is Elon. How's it going, guys?
Pretty good. And I guess our alert listeners will know that Elon used to be on our show until he abandoned us and moved to Ottawa.
Ouch. Well, but it's the one-year anniversary. How could I not come back?
1 year? Oh, my. Have we been on that long?
They've had us on that long.
It's kind of surprising when you think about it, actually, isn't it?
Yeah. I don't think any of us even... imagine that we would be this long-lasting or this popular. I actually just talked to the station manager and pulled up our stats for our podcast. Last month, we were at 72 listeners. This month, just today, we have 96 subscribers to our podcast, and who knows how many are listening live right now.
You know what? I want... 96?
96.
I want four people to subscribe to the podcast right now.
If you're listening live and you're not subscribed to the podcast, subscribe right now and we will try to break 100.
Grab a computer and get it onto iTunes.
During this broadcast.
Unless you're driving.
If you are the 100th person to sign up and we check out the end of the episode, we will send you a t-shirt. So sign up.
How do we figure out who's 100th?
Wait, you guys have t-shirts?
We have some t-shirts. They're not necessarily great t-shirts.
Go to Walmart and buy a t-shirt.
Yeah,
you get your official Radio Freethinker blank white t-shirt.
Exactly, because blank slates, that's what we all start off with, right? Tabula rasa.
Well, so this is our one-year anniversary. I thought it might be interesting if we all sort of reminisce a little bit. You know, where did we begin? Where are we going? Who are we? And what do we stand for? So, why don't I start? How about that? What moments stand out for me doing this show here on CITR? And I guess probably one of the big moments was when we had Jerry Armstrong on our show.
Yeah.
And talking about Scientology. I think that was probably the most interesting time I've ever been in a radio station was listening to him talk about Scientology and everything that cult has done.
For people who were at Skeptic Camp just this past weekend, Jerry Armstrong gave a talk there, as did Radio Freethinker, so you might have seen him there. You can find the show with Jerry Armstrong in our archives on radiofreethinker.com. But yeah, it's actually the most listened to broadcast we've ever done, and is still the number one search hit for Radio Freethinker's blog.
So what about you, Don? What do you think is your favorite moment?
Well, you know, I guess my favorite moment was the moment that I wasn't really quite here. People may know if they look at our archive, there's a sort of blooper reel. But one day I show up a half hour before our show, getting ready to get ready, and I see Ethan and Rob in the studio, and they're talking in the mics. I'm going, what are they doing on the mics? And then I walk in here, and they look at me as if, where the heck have you been, Don? I'm going, why the hell are you guys starting the show a half hour early? And we have this back and forth, but they're on air, so we can't actually say anything.
if only we were an hour show back then.
Yes, when we started, we were actually a half hour show, and we started at 4 p.m. And for some reason, we looked ahead to the future and decided to start it.
Well, there wasn't just some reason. That clock was
the
off.
The clock was not off. That's the thing that drove me insane, because I looked at the clock, because I would have thought I was late if I saw you guys in here.
Elon has something to say.
Yeah, I'm curious. So I remember you guys telling me about that, because that was after I was already gone. So had you recorded over, or were you broadcasting over another show that was supposed to be being played?
Yes, we completely interrupted Native Solidarity News, which used to broadcast during this time slot.
White man That's oppression.
which I think was our third time doing that, because I think we had accidentally started a song over them beforehand. And
That was Daniel's fault.
How ironic.
Actually, Daniel used to be
about
our
native,
sorry, Elon?
No, sorry again.
Yeah, Daniel used to be the show's sound engineer, and he didn't actually say anything on the air, but he was sitting where Ethan is sitting now, controlling the board, and did a pretty okay job.
Yeah. As I recall, you abandoned us as well at some point. You just stopped showing up. It's like, where's Daniel? I don't know.
I did not live close enough to come out here.
Okay. So it wasn't until we became famous that you could suddenly make time to show up from where did you live in Langley? Like, that's what, like 3 or 4 months drive here?
It's a 2-hour transit ride away. And when I had to come pretty much every other day of the week for classes, it made it kind of annoying to come for this as well.
I can hear you typing, Elon. What's up? We're spying on you.
Oh.
Come on, Elon. Tell us your favorite moment on the show.
Maybe I'm chatting with a pretty lady. But actually, I'd have to say my favorite moment was right at the beginning, like just the whole whirlwind of how we got started, and we went to the radio station and asked them if we could have our own show, and we thought... And then we went to this James Randi talk.
Sorry, we'll apologize that we're using Skype and phone lines here, and Ethan, you're cutting out every now and then. I'm not exactly sure why, but try saying that again.
Oh. I guess I was just saying how I really thought it was cool how we had just started the show and went through this whole process, and then just consequently we ended up going to this James Randi talk, and we asked him if he could record a bumper for our show and just say something like, "Hey, this is James Randi and you're listening to Radio Freethinker," and then his handler was like, "Why don't you guys just interview him on the show instead? Would you prefer that?" And next thing you knew, we had for our like opening episode that we were going to basically be using to audition, we had an interview with James Randi on there.
And started a tradition of getting really cool people. We've had Phil Plate, Rebecca Watson, Chris French.
I think it also just helped us get started off by realizing that like these people are accessible. We're not going to be sort of like crawling our way out of the mud.
Though that's not to say that the interview went perfectly well. We had some technical difficulties and we couldn't find James Randi on Skype. So we started like 10 or 20 minutes late. And the first thing to come out of my stupid mouth, because I was so excited about this, the first thing to say was like, "So why are you so eager to come on the show and promote?" and James Randi was like, "Eager?" And I'm just like, "Oh no."
Yes.
Well, that was also when we had told him, like, we've been here, like, we were looking for you, and you weren't online. He was like, "I've been here since 7 a.m. I haven't left my office."
Yes, the first thing we did was annoy James Randi.
Behind the scenes. Going back to the Jerry Armstrong talk, I had never actually heard of Jerry Armstrong before like, one day before that interview. And the way I found him was when we were doing, as part of that show, interviewing the anonymous protesters of Scientology here in Vancouver. And there's some ridiculous stories behind that. If you'd listened to the interview, there was also an extended interview, because I took a lot of time to interview these people from Venonymous. And the first part of the interview actually happens in the children's section of a library, and we were sitting in these tiny little kiddie chairs, and there were children screaming in the background, and the interview actually takes place from us walking from the library to my apartment through a park, and then it started raining. And it's just, if you listen to the extended interview, you can hear all this stuff in the background, and it's just absolutely nuts.
What about you, Daniel? What's your favorite moment from Radio Freethinker?
I was going to say the James Randi thing, which Elon stole, so I am unprepared now.
You don't remember anything else about the show?
No, I pretty much sleep through this.
What about the episode we did on economics, our second or third hour-long special? That was a pretty good one.
Yeah, it was a good one. I like talking about it. Wait, what? Elon's saying something on Skype here. What are you saying, Elon?
I'm saying if you can't think of a memorable moment, I thought it was pretty memorable how last week Rob fell in a puddle and runs in 10 minutes late. Like, sorry, guys, I fell in a puddle and my notes are all wet.
I was 10 minutes late, and it was just horrible. I was running. I was out of breath. I slipped in a puddle, and my notes for that show got completely soaked. My phone had died, so I couldn't contact anybody.
Well, it's a long tradition of us showing up late, showing up too early, or being completely unprepared to be on the air.
I've never done any of those things.
To be fair, though, I think me and Daniel have, I think, on three occasions tried to do a special on economics outside of the one-hour special. And every time we do it, it always ended up so horrible. we'd sit there and we'd be rambling on for hours and hours. It never did quite make a segment.
You should hear some of the segments that they pre-recorded, and they're just... I can't even explain how rambling they were.
Rambling. That was all his fault.
Well, you see, that's why we save this bonus content for our webpage. So check it out at radiofreethinker.com. Well, why don't we...
Speaking of torturous, I have a news item. I'm laying this on these guys without preparation, because I read about it recently, and it's really, really incredible. It's about a fake game show in France.
I've heard about this.
This guy, this documentary producer named Christopher Nick produced a documentary called The Game of Death. But of course, to the participants, it was just a game show. And the game show was really just a rehashing of the Milgram experiment. And everyone knows the Milgram experiment is you had a contestant who was in an electric chair. And they asked him questions. Every time he got a question, the participant, the person who was in the game show trying to win the money, had to electrocute the guy. And every time he got a question wrong, it amped up the electricity a bit more, and to the point where he died from being electrocuted. Now, of course, it was all fake, except for the test subject. But this went on in France, and the idea was, you know, how susceptible are we to peer pressure in these reality game show things, you know, how crazy will be. And if anyone's seen some of the Japanese game shows, there was one I saw recently where the whole premise was someone bursts in and executes everyone in the room, but the unwitting contestant in it, right? And this was a real game show in Japan, and they have some other weird ones. It was just how far people can go. Although us people going to authority is not really new.
I like how psychology researchers aren't allowed to do anything even close to this, and there's no problem when game shows.
Well, I mean, the Milgram experiment in which he looked at how people responded to authority and group pressure, and basically had completely normal ethical people ramping up the voltage and shocking people to kill them, was done in the 60s and led to the whole like ethics and psychology thing.
Well, why don't we just take a quick break, and we'll be back with more of our one-year anniversary special on Radio Free Thinker.
Then there's the utter misery that is college radio, where they apparently just let any bewildered freshman wander into the booth and try to run a radio station. Campus Outreach is looking for... Hang on. College radio can pretty much be summed up in five words.
CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
We are
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker with our good pal Elon all the way in Ottawa.
Just on the subjects of show retrospective, I think we've played that Strong Bad ad more than any show other show on this station.
Well, it's a very good ad, though. Well, it's not actually an ad. It's a station ID.
It's short and succinct.
Right. Well, we were just talking about psychology and brains and stuff like that. And I was reading a very interesting story recently about how brains make us self-absorbed. There's a new article in the Globe and Mail that reports that the brain's orbital frontal cortex may be related to people who think they are, you know, better than average at something when they're actually not very good at it at all. This study about the orbital frontal cortex, people were asked questions about themselves. Those who saw them in the most positive view had significantly less activity in that part of the brain, and those who had a more realistic view of themselves had more activity. So Dr. Jennifer Beer presented at the Frontal Lobes Conference in Toronto this week and explained how the orbital frontal cortex may actually play a role in addiction. The idea behind this is that drug addicts often think of themselves as not needing to get clean, not in any danger, that their habits are not self-destructive. Well, that was kind of interesting because we've talked about addiction before in the past and drug use and on this show. And it kind of got me wondering, what do you think? Do you think skeptics have a particularly active or non-active orbital frontal cortex?
From what I understand, the orbital frontal cortex is often thought to be involved in higher order functioning, things like high functioning reasoning, rationality, ordering stuff properly, logical thinking, and basically it's more measured and careful than other parts of the brain, and it sort of takes information and integrates it into this sort of narratives that we like to tell. So it seems reasonable that increased activity in this reasonable part of the brain will make us feel more reasonable and judge more reasonably our own characteristics.
But what about the fact that, I mean, let's put it, all skeptics are better than most people?
Actually, that's something this is a very long-standing and well-studied effect in psychology. It's called the above-average effect, or the illusory superiority effect. Actually, it's also well known as the Lake Wobegon effect, named after Garrison Keillor's book, in which there's a quote, in Lake Wobegon, all the children are above average. Which, of course, if everyone's above average, then the average would move up, and not everyone would be above average again. So the one really famous example of this is surveys of people's driving ability. These have been done in the 80s and more recently, and anywhere from 80 to 90% of people in these surveys evaluate themselves as being above average at any aspect of driving, when in actual reality, their actual statistics and characteristics of driving are much lower. So people tend to have a stronger view of their selves than is actually true.
And what do you think, Elon?
I think it's interesting. I think a lot of times, though, with these types of studies where it's testing for brain activity, people tend to extrapolate sort of more than what you could actually measure from something like this. So, for example, like if in this study they were talking about specifically people who are, you know, more full of themselves, I guess have less activity, it's sort of hard then, and they're, one person is suggesting that perhaps someone who's more reasonable would have more activity. That might not necessarily end up leading to the skeptics who, you know, we see ourselves in sort of a different linguistic aspect as like more reasonable, but I would guess that if the study was replicated to test if like skeptics have different than religious people, I would guess if I had to make a prediction that we'd all sort of be the same with this specific thing.
Yeah, I think that in general, no one is exempt from this. We all tend to overestimate our own abilities at various things.
I think maybe, too, with going on with what Ethan had said about drug addicts, is that that's a very specific example of how someone, for that particular thing, might overlook it. But maybe we all do it in different ways. I was talking to a friend of mine today who is quite convinced that 2012 is a real thing. And he's very, you know, and you tried to have a rational conversation with him. He says, no, there's something special about it. And he was big about spirituality. It was really quite bizarre. But maybe this is another instance where the the reasonableness has been cut down a bit, and it's expressed itself not as a drug addict, but another way. Or what about someone who is incredibly narcissistic? You know, someone who gets off on being the center of attention and really believes that they are the best person in the real world. Do they have a hyper in this area?
Well, let's just ask you.
Oh, snap.
No, I kid. I joke. Well, interesting enough, though, where you definitely would not want to have somebody very self-absorbed is if you were stuck with them in a small tube for 18 months, which is precisely what's happening in Russia.
Is there some sort of new weird-ass serial killer, or what's going on?
What? Serial killer? No. A bunch of cosmonauts have gotten together, and they are going to be sealed inside a mock spaceship for 18 months to simulate a trip to Mars.
This seems like a bad reality TV show.
I was just going to suggest that, actually. Well, we talked about space exploration a few weeks ago, actually, and we discussed sort of the technological limits of space travel. Well, here's the psychological hurdles. Being stuck in an enclosed space with very little communication back home. You can't go outside. You can't really get away from these people. You're stuck with them for 18 months.
If I remember correctly, Mythbusters did something on this. Not nearly 18 months, but Jamie and Adam went to some cabin and sealed themselves in for, like, just days, and both of them started, like, going crazy and hating each other. And, I mean, it didn't take that long. I mean, maybe there's some pre-existing difficulties between them.
Actually, I think the success of this will be, and you said these are Russian astronauts, right?
Well, there's I believe, three Russians, and there's going to be two Europeans and one Chinese astronaut.
And how much vodka are they bringing up with them?
Well, that's a good question. They are bringing all the food and water with them, and they're actually going to even create an artificial time delay so that when they send messages to, you know, ground control, quote unquote, it's going to take like 20 or 30 minutes back and forth.
Will they be allowed to communicate with family members via this delay, or?
Well, I don't know, actually. I mean, I would assume that space agencies have a system set up so that, you know, your wife or your family can come and send you a message every now and then. But I don't know if it's not going to be like, you know, they just go on Skype or anything and call up their friends.
Well,
like,
I mean, that's, I don't know if anyone else watched the show, but there was a show on CTV that got canceled recently called Defying Gravity about a mission to Mars where somehow the astronauts managed to have, like, completely delayless communication with the people on the ground.
Elon, you have something to say?
Oh, yeah, I guess maybe we have to work on a system so we don't have to keep on.
No, I mean, like, if you want to say something, interrupt. We do it to all each other.
Yeah, I guess it was easier when we were all together, eh? When we could just sort of poke each other in the eye or something when we wanted to chime in. No, but honestly, like, this sounds like the most ridiculous idea. Like, I don't know. I have a feeling that these astronauts, when they're in the middle of doing this study, they're going to feel like, why did I get myself into this? This is not helping anyone, really, and it's just going to be really miserable for them.
I think psychologically, it's missing one important thing, too. I mean, they're going to be isolated in close containers, but they kind of know at any moment if they need to. They could open the door and walk out, or they could call someone. Whereas if you're in a real mission to Mars, one of the oppressing psychological things is that there isn't anyone there. I was listening to...
Well, then again, this is Russia. They might not open the door if they start...
No, they will, but they're going to try to persuade them not to. But the exact same point with you, Don. I mean, like, this defeats the kind of purpose, doesn't it? Like, what we're talking about here, they're trying to simulate the psychological isolation. You can't really do that.
No, and it's actually something that's actually kind of been done before. I mean, there have been other instances. I was reading the other day about, what is it, the Shackleton expedition to the Antarctic, where they, with 3 years, these people all together trying to struggle to survive. I mean, granted, they were out in the fresh air, but they were isolated, they were alone, they were together and had to rely on each other, and you had the same sort of thing. And, of course, Elon's not going to interrupt me again, but Elon, what do you think about that?
Nah. No, I was going to say, like, another thing is that they don't have the excitement of knowing that after the 18 months, they'll be on Mars, which is probably a very different psychological motivation.
They just open it out and, oh, we're back in Russia.
No, I'm sure Russia's a very nice place.
It's very cold.
They have...
It's probably nicer than Mars.
Probably, yes. I would imagine so, but not as exciting. Well, maybe exciting. I don't know. Never been to Russia, actually. But, you know, what's interesting... if these cosmonauts want to know how to behave, maybe they should look to dogs. And I'm referring to...
Please explain that segue.
Yes. There was an article published in Scientific America where researchers suggest that dogs and canines, like wolves, have a far more sophisticated social structure than previously thought. Further, that the sort of societies that dogs and wolves set up in their little groups actually resembles early human hunter-gatherer societies.
Yeah, I remember reading about this, and I think Don actually mentioned it in his talk at Skepticamp. But as I recall, there was something about how dogs will feel sorry if they break social rules and display like their bellies or other submissive postures when they feel that they've broken a social rule.
Well, one of the big things about this, I mean, as far as animals feeling empathy and all that, I mean, everyone thinks of chimpanzees or dolphins or something, but the fact that dogs and canines have this, and they do, they have a very specific language. I mean, one of the things you might see if two dogs are together is they do this what they call bowing position, where the front paws go right down on the ground and their ass goes up in the air, and it's a universal signal from dogs saying, hey, I want to play. If I bite you or anything, it's just joking. I'm not really trying to hurt you and all that. And there's an ethics, a morality to what they're doing, because part of the thing is if you break the rules, you get punished, and dogs will get ostracized from the community group and all.
Yeah, and it has actually evolutionary effects. They've studied wolf packs, and wolves who break the rules and like they'll say that they're going to play, but they actually attack someone physically, will be shunned from the group and become a lone wolf, and they are more likely to die than wolves who stay in a cohesive pack.
It's even more complicated than that. Is one of the things that you're supposed to do as an ethical dog is to handicap yourself if you happen to be a bigger dog than the other dog, if you happen to be more powerful, is you have to appropriately limit yourself in your abilities. And if you don't even do that, again, you suffer the social controversy. Don't you agree, Elon?
I think that it would be interesting to know if this idea of the dogs being more having this more complex social structure, I wonder if this has been influenced by their coevolution with humans, or if it is like completely unrelated to the fact that dogs evolved sort of due a lot to human factors. Because if you're talking about wolves, a lot of wolves didn't evolve due to humans and trying and like being more successful if they were more cooperative with humans.
Well, I actually was I was watching a documentary on this, actually. And from what I understand of the documentary's argument was that humans domesticated wolves that would demonstrate domesticative traits. So, for example, wolves that were naturally more submissive, wolves that were a bit more timid, were more likely to be domesticated, whereas wolves that were a bit more aggressive, a bit more dominant, tended to, bite people. So I guess we're not very good options for domestication. So I would suggest that, well, at least I would think that these sort of traits that they're learning through play is something that they've developed unique to their own, and that humans might have tapped into when we were domesticating wolves into dogs.
I think the study itself actually makes reference to wolves and coyotes as well as dogs. So I think it is a non-human specific trait. I think what Ethan's getting at is there's a sort of a secondary coevolution, is that animals or dogs anyhow, or wolves, whatever, that are willing to extend the pack idea to something that is not a wolf, that is willing to accept a human as part of the pack and then use its moral code with that, they're the ones that became domesticated. Whereas if you're a speciist, and lots of wolves are speciists, especially if you're caught out in the wild, and they might think of you as just lunch and not as a member of their pack.
Well, we can always ask Farley, what about that? Anyway, why don't we go to a quick commercial break, and we'll be back with more on our one-year anniversary Radio Freethinker special.
CITR has more friends than ever before. We've partnered with tons of local businesses to bring you great discounts in the communities where you live, work, and play. Maybe Main Street is your main drag. Present your Friends of CITR card at Red Cat Records, Lucky's Comics, Devil May Wear, Thriller, Blim, Hotbox, The Kiss Store, The Wallflower Modern Diner, RX Comics, Antisocial Skateboard Shop, Vinyl Records, Regional Assembly of Text, and Twig and Hottie to receive fabulous discounts. So become a CITR member, get a free Friends card, and feel the love.
It's our pledge drive here on NPR, and we have a 20-minute field recording of a tumluku, which is a Bosnian instrument which can only be played when you have a pierced scrotum and three kids who have been killed by a landmine. It's unlistenable radio! You understand me?
You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver. Totally listenable radio.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking, and is still looking for 4 subscribers on iTunes. Please subscribe, and we will be very happy.
Then you'll break 100 subscribers.
That's right. Watch out, SGU. Well, we were just talking about dog society and how it might relate to early human society. So why don't we talk about hobbit society? And no, that's not a reference to Lord of the Rings.
These segues are gold, people.
I spent 5 hours coming up with these. So we all remember the hobbit discovery on the Indonesian island of Flores. I think I'm saying that right. And there's a recent discovery that now suggests the hobbits, or perhaps a different group of hominins, was there nearly a million years ago, which is 120,000 years earlier than previously thought. So this discovery for the hobbits, or actually Homo floresiensis, lived alongside humans until about 18,000 years ago is when they went extinct. Well, they found a new site that has revealed tools that are dated to be just over a million years old. Now, what does this mean? We don't know who used these tools. We don't even know they were used by hobbits. They could have been used by any others.
Aliens?
Maybe. Although, why would aliens need, like, stone tools? Won't they just use, like, their ray guns or something? But anyway, there's not enough evidence to say they were used by the hobbits, or really, we don't know who they were used for, but they were used. And it does cast some significant doubt on the evolutionary theory of how hobbits came to be. That theory stating that they are like an offshoot of Homo erectus. So what this could imply is that hobbits evolved separately in Africa and colonized Asia long before human beings or Homo sapiens started spreading out or Homo erectus started spreading out.
So, Ethan, you're saying that since there's a flaw in one of our specific theories of how evolution works, we should just throw out all of evolution, right? It must all be false?
Yes, that's exactly what I'm saying. No. Well,
that's
this actually really isn't a flaw in evolution. This is a flaw in one theory for a particular group of people, people. This actually, in many ways, I think, confirms and reaffirms evolution. It just pushes the clock back, perhaps a little bit.
So as I understand it, we had the precursors to modern humans before they were erect in Africa. And then one of them split up and went to Europe and then became the Neanderthals. But there was also a different one that went to Asia and became the hobbits.
Yeah, see, that's the big controversy. No one really knows exactly how this happened, and we don't even know if, obviously we call them hobbits for a reason, they're a smaller person, sized person there. We don't know if they shrunk when they got there, if they were always small, if they the original theory was that they were like an offshoot, a genetically isolated population that for whatever reason developed dwarfism. We don't know. There are competing theories about whether or not they're their own separate group. I tend to personally think that the evidence seems to indicate that they are actually a separate order of hominid. So it's quite interesting. It does cast some doubt on the notion that the hobbits were the ones that caused the extinction of pygmy elephants and other animals on Flores. The tools, however, discovered would suggest that people have been living there for, you know, again, 120,000 years. So it looks like hominins did not cause the mass extinction of a whole bunch of unique animals to that area, which, who knows, might cast suspicion on the idea that the megafauna of North America were exterminated by early humans.
Actually, I heard that it was alien experimentation that wiped out the megafauna and that. Actually, on a related note, there's something I learned recently that again, just struck me as really bizarre. Now, the first believed human habitation of Australia was something like 65,000 years ago. Okay, that's great. And then Easter Island, believe it or not, was supposed to be inhabited about 400 CE, Common Era. When do you think New Zealand was first colonized? Now remember, New Zealand, Australia, relatively close by. Any ideas?
1945.
Oh, you are closer than you think. About 1300 CE. Now, I'm looking at a map.
There's no evidence before that?
There's no. The Maori, who are believed to be the indigenous people of New Zealand, showed up in 1300 CE and settled. And I'm looking at that. I'm going, 65,000, and there's just a short little gap. They even made it to Easter Island, which is the most remote island, apparently, in the world. Right? They made it to there at 400 CE, and it took them 1,000 years just to get this little, which is really bizarre.
Is New Zealand then, like, the biggest, or the only major landmass that, like, took, I don't know,
like humans haven't settled?
Yeah, humans didn't settle until, like, well into the common era.
I'm gonna say yes. If anyone out there knows different, please email us at...
radio.freethinker@gmail.com. But I was going to ask you there, Don, so are the native New Zealanders, are they an offshoot of the people who colonized Australia?
No. From this is a documentary, something about when monsters walked among us or something like that, right? So they're actually Polynesian in origin, whereas the Australian Aborigine are actually a different genetic stock, although they are Homo sapien, just like the Polynesians. But that's why if you look at a Maori, and you look at an Aboriginal from Australia, they look very differently in the same way that someone from tropical Africa looks different than someone from Norway.
That's quite interesting, because, I mean, I guess the Polynesians were sailors. And I don't know too much about Aboriginal Australian history, but I don't know if they were seafarers.
No, again, you know, like there's the Polynesian, the Maori going to New Zealand was actually colonizing, is the impression, because they apparently brought a lot of their natural fauna. They brought rats to the island, which was kind of bad, but they didn't know at this time, that sort of thing.
Ugh.
Whereas the Aboriginals seem to have sort of just shown up with logs. Who knows how exactly they got there, but no, it was quite bizarre. Of course, shortly after the Aboriginals showed up in Australia, all the megafauna disappeared. So.
Mm. Well, wow. They were very hungry, I guess. I have one more story that I found this week, because so far we haven't actually talked anything about how the media is bad at reporting science this week, and we like to do that at least once a week.
Yes, that's true.
So
let me guess, is it the Georgia Strait?
Actually, it isn't. It has nothing to do with the Georgia Strait, surprisingly. Actually, that's one of the other things. While we're on a retrospective of a show, I have always been very entertained by our extreme hatred for the Georgia Strait and Sonia McLeod.
And by Howard, I'm guessing you mean the new executive director of CFI Vancouver, specifically.
You know what? It's funny. I've been sending the Georgia Strait event postings for our CFI events, and for some reason, they don't seem to post them. I don't know why that is.
But back on the subject of more responsible media and their occasional difficulty with reporting science, the Archives of Internal Medicine recently did a review of nearly 2,300 articles published from 2005 to 2007 from several different newspapers, magazines, and local news magazines and reports on their reports on cancer. And they found that, in general, they tended to report on aggressive treatment and survival rather than treatment failure or death or end-of-life and hospice care. So they took a random sample from all these articles and found, and this is some pretty crazy statistics. We'll post it up on the show notes so you can look at some of the other ones. But only 13% reported that aggressive treatment can fail or that some cancers are as yet incurable. And so they're basically saying how these newspaper reports, almost all of them about cancer, are completely non-reflective of the realities of cancer or cancer research. Less than one-third of them even mention side effects that are common to cancer treatments, like nausea, pain, or hair loss.
On this note, though, I'm pretty sure I've read and heard about lots of decent scientific evidence that being optimistic improves your chance of improving from cancer treatments. So, and a lot of things in general. So is it really that bad that they're portraying a slightly optimistic worldview for cancer treatments?
I suppose it depends on whether you want your media to present you with completely accurate information or not. I'm of the opinion personally that it's not impossible to both be realistic and optimistic.
Well, I recall James Randi was saying when he was doing his treatment that he was optimistic. He fully expected himself to recover, not because he...
Uh-oh. What? I think we've dropped Elon.
I guess he just got really bored. as I was saying, James Randi was optimistic. He believed he was going to get better, not because he believed in, you know, supernatural powers or because he was fed the wrong information. He just had a positive outlook. And I think that if you get the right information, you can have a positive outlook and be aware that there's going to be side effects. I think if you're prepared for them, like if someone says, listen, you're going to lose your hair, you're going to lose weight, you're going to get sick, I think then you have a better chance of dealing with these problems when they come up, as opposed to being like, I'm going to get better, and then all of a sudden, you know, you lose all your hair and you get really weak. It's very deflating to your sense of, you know, optimism.
No, there's a book recently published, I think, by someone named Barbara Ehrenreich. I don't know if I'm remembering that correctly, but it's all about how cancer researchers and cancer patients have this sort of disconnect where cancer patients think that all you really need to do is to be optimistic. You'll hear some noise as well. Don is trying to put Elon back on the air. But there's also a really, really good article by Stephen Jay Gould, the famous evolutionary biologist, called The Median Is Not the Message, in which he talks about how learning about the statistics behind cancer helped him with his own battle with cancer. And I highly recommend that everyone look that up and read it.
Are you back, Elon?
Yes, I'm back.
Welcome back.
So you just didn't get...
I missed something about Stephen Jay Gould. What a shame.
Yeah. Well, listen to the podcast. Anyway, you know, actually, it's funny, though, Rob. I recall reading an episode of Skeptical Inquirer that really sort of dived into this whole cancer issue. And I remember getting quite the impression that we are sort of looking at cancer research through rose-tinted glasses, so to speak. And the situation is actually a lot worse than I think most people are aware of.
Yeah, that's possibly due to the results that this study found, that the news media tend to report very optimistically and a bit unrealistically about cancer treatment and ignoring the effects of it and failures of it.
Hmm. Well, that's kind of depressing. Well, why don't we shift to a more uplifting topic like nuclear power?
Hooray!
Let's inject some energy into this conversation.
I think we can come back to that after an ad or a station ID. Do we have any left to play? I'm not sure.
We have one we can play. Well, we have a couple. We have many, actually.
All right.
The state of hip-hop right now, man, as far as the way I see it, I think right now... hip-hop is advancing as far as skills. You got brothers, you know what I'm saying, getting, like, more witty.
There ain't nobody to be pretty for. Let it rattle. Let the clatter kill him. Let the cataclysm wash. Who really listens? Precision with a verse draws a cry. I draw a line between an easy melody and peace of mind.
Uh-huh. You got DJs doing all kind of crazy shit on the turntables. I like where it's going, and I like, you know what I'm saying, the creative process that brothers is trying to take it to right now.
Rally Rails and Brendan Butter in the place to be. Crimes and Treasons Radio, 101.9 FM, Vancouver, CITR.ca, every Tuesday, 9 till 11.
Dynamite!
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. And we're talking with our pal Elon all the way in Ottawa. And we're going to talk about nuclear power.
Actually, it's really good that Elon's in Ontario, because Ontario is the heartbed of Canada's nuclear power energy. Does things glow in the dark there, Elon, at night? Because we all hear that nuclear energy radiates everything around you. And I just thought, you know, you don't need nightlights there, do you?
Well, the thing, it's not that things are glowing in the dark, but since I have my third eye, sort of the things I see sort of look differently, and so it appears to me like they're glowing. It's a bit different.
Are you implying that you evolved from the Simpsons fish or a Springfield fish?
we'll nickname you Elon Blinky Dubrovsky.
just to give a basic rundown, nuclear energy is essentially fission power as opposed to fusion power. You might hear a lot of talk about fusion energy, which is what the sun does. You take two hydrogen atoms, you slam them together, and you create helium. That's fusion, and there's no nuclear waste. Fission, on the other hand, is where you take something like uranium or plutonium or thorium, and you split it up into decayed particles, and you get energy from that. which is really good. We've been through many generations of nuclear power plants. The first generation plants were like, you know, the Manhattan Project. Second generation plants were things like the CANDU reactor, which is something Canadians should be very proud of because we were pioneers in nuclear energy until we basically pissed it away with... but anyhow, I won't go down.
I blame Greenpeace.
Currently, we are what they call the third generation or third generation plus, which is essentially the old type of reactors. Like CANDU reactors use what they call heavy water, which is deuterium, and it's a little expensive or whatever. Third generation plus limits that. It's an evolutionary advance. But the real area is what they call fourth generation plants, which is what they're planning to build the next generation, which are much more safer in regards to a lot of them. One popular design is what they call passive safety. So the hotter the reaction gets, the weaker the reactions are. So if you get an uncontrolled fission reaction, it actually dampens itself, so you don't actually need safety measures to prevent supercritical. Although, of course, that's one breed. There are still other breeds that you need these passive things. They're called fast reactors. Fast reactors are kind of bad because they produce plutonium and all that kind of thing, which some countries in the world are being accused of being bad neighbors for having weaponizable nuclear programs. I won't mention Iran on the air. But they use gas as a mediator to cool things off, and they run at very high temperatures. That's one of the things. The higher the temperature, the better the efficiency. But using gas as opposed to the traditional thing, which is using water, gas doesn't pick up contaminants. You can't really irradiate gas for some reason. So again, there's a lot of improvements in the safety of these fourth generation nuclear power plants, which are hopefully to be built in the next 5 to 10 years.
So basically, we don't have to worry about the sort of runaway chain reactions that cause meltdowns at Chernobyl and Three Mile Island.
Exactly. And actually, that's one of the big bugaboos that come up here is the idea of safety, right? And accidents is a big thing. And there actually have been, since Chernobyl, there have been less than 20 incidents with nuclear power. Out of those, only two of them resulted in quote-unquote off-site contamination. Now, some of them have resulted in staff members being injured or killed. Sorry for them and their family, but only a few.
You know, I just kind of want to jump in there, Don, but like, if we were to talk about people getting killed in accidents, I mean, how many people die in regular power plant accidents as well, right?
Well, you've got that, and plus there's been a big study about coal burning in China, where there's a specific kind of coal that they use that actually increases the likelihood of lung cancer and all that because of something that was in the coal when it formed. So, again, relatively speaking, you know, the accidents aren't a big thing. Actually, one of the biggest fears they have about it is the whole idea of terrorism. Now, one of the things I discovered when I was doing my research, do you know how long it takes to shut down a nuclear power plant if you have to do it right away?
5 minutes.
Ethan?
An hour.
Several days?
5 seconds.
Wow.
They have emergency systems that apparently will do it in 5 seconds. Now, this can be done quite easily if you think about it, because most of reactors use what they call mediators, or they have control rods.
Yeah, they're made out of carbon, as I understand, and they basically soak up the spare neutrons or whatever is powering the chain reaction, and it completely shuts it down.
Exactly. So you just have a system that sort of drops all the rods in at the same time, and it cuts everything out. Another weird thing, you know, they always worry that they're going to be 9/11, that you're going to take a plane and crash into them. But another safety feature of nuclear power plants, because people are worried that they're going to explode, right? And there are instances, not nuclear explosion, but there are instances where you can have explosions. Chernobyl, great example, right? But they're built inside of their reinforced hardened structures to prevent explosions going out.
Yeah, the actual reaction chambers are really hard to get to. I mean, it's important to remember that in reality, nuclear power plants and most other kinds of power plants are just big old steam engines, and the part that boils the water is the nuclear reaction.
Exactly, and actually they're double encased. You have the plant itself, and then there's a secondary containment structure that's built over top of it. So essentially, if you slammed an airplane into a nuclear power plant, now don't get me wrong, it'd screw up the nuclear power plant. It wouldn't be operating, and they'd have damage and all that.
And there would be boiling water everywhere.
Yeah, but there'd be no risk of nuclear explosion, or even of the idea of dirty bombs. And actually, that's the other thing they're worried about: is, well, with all this nuclear waste, you know, isn't somebody going to steal it and take it? And that was a really valid thing. For those of you who remember, there was the breakup of the Soviet Union, and that one of the reasons why the Soviet Union dissolved was money. And everyone was worried that there was all this nuclear power, nuclear material. The Soviet Union, you may not be aware of this, were actually involved in what they call strontium nuclear reactors. They were low-level nuclear power reactors that you could travel around on the back of a truck, essentially. And some of these went missing. And as it's turned out, and since, have anyone heard of a dirty bomb?
Is that a missing like nuclear weapon or something?
Dirty bomb is when you take waste and use it to
as a thing. So instead of constructing a bomb, but they were worried that at the fall of the Soviet Union there was going to be all this material going out there. And some of it has shown up in bizarre places, but a lot of it has been what you call accidental. So you have lead container, or a container that was used in a power plant being sold as scrap, right? But there have been no real terrorist actions. So again, I think this idea that you could use the waste as a dirty bomb is theoretically possible, but no more of a greater risk.
Wouldn't the implication,
it happened on 24.
But wouldn't the implication of using that kind of waste be almost more trouble than it's worth? I mean, aren't they extremely difficult to manage nuclear waste?
Well, yeah, that's one of the limiting factors, is that people who handle nuclear waste tend to die, especially if you don't do it under very proper controlled circumstances. So if you are a likely terrorist who happens to have a pound of nuclear waste in your hand, well, one, your hands would be burnt because it's actually very, very hot. And two, you'd be dead within a couple of days just from the nuclear
radiation. Although they probably don't care about killing themselves very much, do they?
No, but it makes transporting it somewhat noticeable.
Yes. You can't really sneak it onto an airplane.
And actually...
Continue.
Another bizarre thing, this goes with the nuclear waste, is a lot of things, well, you got all this nuclear waste, what are you going to do with it?
Yeah, that's the question I was going to have. I mean, like, is storing it difficult, or is the amount produced greater, the same, or less than the amount of pollution generated by your average coal plant?
Well, oddly enough, in about a year, a plant produces about 30 tons of waste in itself, and out of that, only about 3 cubic meters of it are actually, you know, hot waste. But one of the big issues is where are you going to store it? Right now, they're stored on site. They have cooling pools or whatever, right? And if that factors in, as far as the cost of the plant, only about 10 or 13% of the per kilowatt running thing. But they had a thing in the United States, they had this Yucca Mountain project, where they were going to store it all in one place in very safe contained areas. They could have security, they could have monitoring of it to make sure it doesn't go all that. But you have NIMBA. Anyone know what NIMBA stands for?
NIMBY?
NIMBY, thank you.
National.
No.
Incredibly.
Not in my backyard.
So they had this. They had this big uproar. Well, we don't want to do this. So they've the one place where they could have actually stored it safely, guarded everything, they destroyed because they said, oh, we don't want nuclear waste in our backyard. We don't want to have all this. It's still there. Actually, the United States right now has 101 nuclear power plants, which produce only about actually 17% of its energy, which tells you how wasteful Americans are. France has 59 nuclear power plants, and it produces about 76% of its power through nuclear energy. But right now, it's become a really hot topic because climate change. Everyone says, well, we've got to cut down on CO2 and all that. And actually, ironically enough, even if you factor in construction costs and all that, nuclear power plants work out to be something like, 57%... fewer carbon emissions overall than you would. And that's factoring in, because you have to actually mine the uranium, you know, and you have to process it. I worked out somewhere a 1 kilogram of processed uranium, so you could actually put it into the plant, costs about $2,555 per kilogram. This is from, nuclearenergy.org or something. It's like a UN factory that goes into that.
And you can get that from Canada. Yeah. We're the world's largest exporter of uranium.
Well, and we have actually the highest quality. Although the people with the most uranium is Australia.
Oh.
And I really think if we have to preserve for democracy another nation, we should move into Australia to protect their democratic...
their abundant national resources.
One of the weird things, actually, when you do a breakdown of the cost per kilowatt hours, it works out in Canada... Nuclear energy is like $3.71 per kilowatt hour to produce. Coal comes out at $4.12 and gas at $4.36. So again, per kilowatt hours, nuclear energy is quite cheap. In France, it's even better. They have like $3.93 per kilowatt hour versus coal, which is $4.50, and gas, which is $4.30 per all that.
So it's actually cheaper, safer, and less polluting than other kinds of energy?
Per kilowatt hour. Where it gets killed is in construction of the plant. And a lot of that it's been regulated almost to death. And yes, this is me, the leftist, far left person saying that in 1974, to build a nuclear power plant cost $382 million. By 1988, the same company building the same kind of plant, it cost them $2.9 billion to do the same thing. The current construction of the plants that Obama has just offered to underwrite in the United States is going to cost $8 billion. And a lot of that money goes into getting licensing, because in the United States you have to get a license to build the plant, then you have to get another license to operate the plant, and on top of that there's regulations. Most regulations, you know, we start off, this is what we want to do. As time goes by, we find out what's good and what's bad. With the nuclear power, they've said the more the better, and they keep piling on more and more things, because again, politically, nuclear energy is a really, really hot topic, and that's where you get this ballooning.
One might even say it's radioactive.
No, they wouldn't say that. Oh. Never, ever say that.
I think they might.
No.
Ironically enough, the one place in the world where nuclear power is really taking off is, anyone, starts with a C, five letters.
China.
China. Yes. China is going to be is in the middle of constructing 18 nuclear power plants because of its wonderful government, it doesn't have to worry so much about public opinion. To put that nicely. I've hit upon this before. You know, I don't like big corporations in general, but with intelligent regulation, with intelligent things, there's nothing inherently wrong with it. Nuclear energy is a very viable source. We have to make sure it's dealt with properly. But fear-mongering and all that, it just did.
In conclusion, Greenpeace are jerks.
Yeah. Well, I would love to hear our listeners' opinions on this, so please email us at radio.freethinker@gmail.com.
Or comment on the show notes on our website at radiofreethinker.com.
That's true. And we're sort of winding down on time. So, Elon, how's it feel to be back on the show?
Well, I mean, you know how it is, guys. Great time always hanging out at the radio station, even though I'm just there virtually.
Yeah.
But, I definitely miss being on the show with you. It was always a lot of fun, and it's just amazing that you've kept the show going for a year, and it's, like, become an hour show now, and you're getting all of these listeners. Very impressive.
Just so our listeners know, you can listen to Elon on The Reality Check, which is a podcast you can find on iTunes.
Do you guys have, like, a webpage or something that you can go to? Or
yeah, actually, if you go to OttawaSkeptics.org, you could find, or you could just search on iTunes, though, for The Reality Check. In fact, we were on the top list of Something for Science podcasts, and if you search for Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, right after the SGU podcast, Reality Check comes up next.
Excellent.
It's pretty exciting stuff.
Yeah.
Hopefully Radio Freethinker will join
in,
too.
We're done in for you.
comes next for now.
Yeah. Well, I have a skeptical highlight I'd like to mention. CFI is having a talk on Friday, March 26th here at UBC, and it's talked by Pat O'Brien at the Victoria Learning Theater. And the talk is called, Why Do You Have to Make Things So Complicated? It's a talk all about how skeptics don't exactly make things easy on themselves. Pat's a former president of the Humanist Association of Canada, the past president of the BC Humanist Association, and he's currently on the board of directors for CFI Canada. So a very intelligent young, or not young man, very intelligent, distinguished person. And we look forward to hearing what he has to say.
And I have a skeptic highlight out there, just another one. The Spartacus Youth Club is presenting the Vanguard Party and the Fight for the Socialist Revolution. I'm not sure whether this is a right-wing or a left-wing thing. You can go and check it out. It's at 6:30 p.m. At the UBC in the sub, room 224. Again, if you're for or against, I say recommend coming out. The Trotskyists are a bit instrumental for my liking, but still, it's a good point of view. It's something you should check out.
I don't have an event to promote, but I just recently finished watching a PBS documentary that finished airing a couple weeks ago called Human Spark. It's hosted by Alan Alda, and he talks about what about humans makes us unique in the animal kingdom. And he talks about everything from anthropology to chimp studies to cognitive psychology and infant research. And a bit about how dogs co-evolve with humans, as we talked about on our show earlier. So I highly recommend it. You can find it on PBS's website.
And Daniel, I understand that the UBC Freethinkers are doing something.
Yes, on Wednesday night, we are having an annual general meeting to elect people for next year. And please, if you're a UBC student who is interested in the skeptical community and furthering it at UBC, please come out and at least vote, preferably run. That's Wednesday at 7 at room 415 in Irving K. Barber, I believe. You can check out.
So, Daniel, are you going to be the new president?
We'll see.
Well, he can't really announce it. That would imply that we know the results ahead of time, which we don't. Well, we're right out of time. So, Elon, thanks for joining us. And I look forward to listening to the next episode of The Reality Check.
Hey, thanks. And I just signed up for TAM, the amazing meeting in Vegas in July. So you guys should come hang out with me there.
We can do some more interviews.
All righty.
All right. Well, this is Ethan, your free-thinking historian, saying goodnight.
This is Don saying eyes open, minds on.
This is Rob saying here's to one more year of Radio Freethinker.
Here's Daniel saying thanks for listening.
And when he said one more year, he wasn't one more. It's like one more and many more after that.
this is Elon saying think better to act better.
Aw.
It's an inside joke from, not an inside joke. If you listen to The Reality Check, you'll know what I'm talking about.
All right. Good night, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Big government and big pharma have entered into a secret conspiracy in which secret government contracts are sold to big pharma that allow for secret chemicals to be placed in coffee seeds. All